I didn't take that. It's off the web. You can go find them yourself. But anytime you go to a picture like that, the one thing it doesn't do is scale, right? You can't tell whether those are, you know, bigger than a bread box or smaller than a house kind of thing. So this is the scale. That's a Murex shell. They're not that big. Can you imagine how, and there's just a little gland inside that they use out of the thing. So can you imagine how many of these things it takes to dye a garment? And that's why it was a pretty expensive dye. But as with many things that are expensive, there's a clientele that wants to pay money for them, right? Because they've got something nobody else does. And so that's where Lydia was going. But what that also says is that she was a woman of some means, right? And how else can we judge the fact that she had a fairly good presence there in what city? Philippi. Okay, we're in Philippi. We're in Greece in Philippi. After she's baptized, remember last week when we were talking about it, what did she do? She invited them to come and to stay with her. Now, we know that there's at least four here now, right? We've got Paul, and it's not Barnabas this time. Who is it? Silas. And we've picked up the historian to go along the way, who is Luke. And Paul picked up a favored son on his way over there. Who was that? Timothy. So we've got at least four of them there. And keep that in mind as we move on to this chapter. So Lydia has invited them in. Where were they meeting? Where did they meet Lydia? Down by the river. Now, last week we said a couple things about that. They went there supposing that would be a place of prayer. What does that tell us about Philippi? What didn't it have? A synagogue. No synagogue there, right? But they at least had a location outside of town where if some people were going to be meeting who were of the Jewish persuasion and were going to be spending the Sabbath there, they kind of knew where that would be, and they went and found them. And then it looks like they would continue on the Sabbath to go back and to meet with them. And so we look at beginning in verse 16, it says that it happened that as they were going to the place of prayer, so they're on another Sabbath going back to that same place again, that a slave girl, having a spirit of divination, met us, who was bringing her masters much profit by fortune-telling. And following after Paul and us, she kept crying out, saying, "These men are bondservants of the Most High God, who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation." And she continued doing this for many days. But Paul was greatly annoyed and turned and said to the Spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out at that very moment. And there's a number of things in this that I think we kind of need to think through a little bit. They're going out to this place of prayer, and there's some girl who is a slave, and he uses two words there to talk about what she is doing that her masters are using to make profit off of. What are those two words? It says that that are used to describe what she does. Okay, fortune telling was one of them. What's the other one? Divination. Okay, and your translations may be slightly different there, but both of them have kind of a different connotation. Under even Old Testament language, divination was what people would do when they would try to do things like read entrails or find out what's going on by divining into something, whether it was casting stones or cutting up animals or whatever it happened to be. There are all kinds of different guises that fit in. But the idea was that they would be doing something that would allow them to give advice to people or to see the future or to do something. Fortune-telling. Typically was a trance-like thing. That's kind of what that word implies there. And even today, fortune tellers, I don't know, I've never talked to one who claims to be, but you can see them on TV, right? And they always go into this, trance with their crystal ball or whatever. But the point is that she was out there telling people things that she thought she saw or whatever. And apparently, there's some spirit in her. Now, this is where we have some interesting discussions this day and age as we start talking about, was she really telling the future, or was it just that the Spirit was driving her to things? We don't know, but she was following around behind Paul and Barnabas saying what? We have to be careful with this statement here as we look at it. What was her cry that she was saying? Okay, these are servants of the Most High God, and Okay, they're proclaiming to you, and most translations put the way of salvation. Some of them will put a way of salvation. It turns out there's no article there. It's not a definite article. It really should be better translated if we look at it as proclaiming to you a way of salvation. Now, what's interesting about this is we read that, and what do we immediately think? Well, we think of the servant of the Most High God. Who's the Most High God? Okay, God, right? How would a Greek or a Roman have interpreted the statement, the Most High God? Probably Zeus or Apollos or one, I mean, you know, one of those kind of Apollo. I guess Zeus and Apollo are the Greek and Roman equivalent, right? No? Okay. Who's the Zeus and Jupiter? Right, okay, yeah. You can tell my mythology is not all that good sometimes. But the point is that that statement, while true, right, could have been misleading to those who heard it because it wasn't qualified, right? Secondly, they're saying they proclaim to you a way of salvation, but without using the definite article there, what would it imply if I said, this is a way that you can do something? That there might be other ways, right? And instead, if I say, this is the way to do something, you know, my way or the highway, right? Then you say, oh, well, maybe there's not any other way to do it. So while she was speaking truth, I think that in that culture, in that day, it would not necessarily have been understood in the way that Paul would have preferred for those people to understand. You see there? So in while she's saying true, why was it that Paul's getting annoyed? See, that's the real question there. It says that Paul got annoyed. He was bothered by what she was saying. Now, if she's just going around telling the truth, why would Paul get bothered? Is it possible to tell the truth and deceive? It really is. And I think that's part of what we're looking at here, is that this woman, in addition to, I mean, there were times when Jesus encountered people who were possessed by spirits, right? And in some cases, what was his driving emotion that caused him to cast those spirits out? Many times. Pity, compassion, you know, he felt for those people. What does it say about Paul here? Does it say anything about that? It doesn't, okay? Now, that doesn't mean he didn't feel some compassion there, but that's not what caused him to do it. You see that it also occurred over some time, right? She was following them around. He didn't do it immediately. So there's a bunch of questions there.
I like
that could be annoying too, absolutely. She just won't hush up, right? And while she may be proclaiming this, it's not helping their cause. And so he takes care of it by doing what? Telling the spirit to come out. Now, we don't have time. It would take a lot of class. Go ahead. I certainly think that's part of it. They did not want to be seen as associated with that, you know, that's not part of what they're teaching. They didn't hire this girl to follow them around and proclaim, you know, their goodness or whatever, or their service. So I think there's a number of factors here that lead up to this. Now, the question that many will have is that something that could happen today? Do spirits possess people today? And we can talk about that, and I'll briefly give you the Cliff Note highlights, because we covered a lot of it in the book of Revelation. And if you've got other questions, certainly feel free to ask, and we can bring them up. But when it talks about Satan being bound, if you'll notice that during the time of when the apostles were on the earth and when Jesus was on the earth, there were a number of these instances where the servants of Satan were able to possess people and take over. But in those cases where you hear it, we also find that there were people who had the authority of Christ to cast them out at the same time. Now, if we look at those spiritual gifts over time disappearing because the apostles died off, the ones on whom the apostles laid their hands died off, I think there you see that same kind of situation going, that that which is perfect is coming, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13. And when that occurred, which is the revelation that we have, there wasn't any need for that anymore. And that's the picture I think he talks about when he says Satan is bound in Revelation. That he's not allowed to roam the earth freely anymore. He's not allowed to do those things. And so the balance is still there. Okay? God hasn't allowed a situation to occur where people do not have free will and the ability to choose. And so one of the things that Paul is doing here is reestablishing this girl's free will, right? By throwing off this satanic influence. But what she does after that, we don't know. And that's kind of another curious thing, too. Did she maybe follow Paul after that, or did she not? We don't know. But that situation got Paul in trouble, because now he's done the one thing you never do when you want to be popular. You mess with somebody's income, right? And that's what's happened here. So the crowd rose up together. Oh, okay, but in verse 19, but when her master saw that their hope of profit was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities. And when they had brought them to the chief magistrates, they said, these men are throwing our city into confusion, being Jews, and are proclaiming customs which it is not lawful for us to accept or to observe, being Romans. Now, Philippi, the ruins are still kind of there. And I don't know, I find it very interesting when I'm reading about a place like this. If you can search the web, you can look and you can find these kind of pictures. One of these days, I'd love to get over there and see some of these things. But then for now, I'll just have to live with the pictures. But that forum, that marketplace, that agora where they hauled Paul is still there. And those pillars are still standing. And it gives you a sense of the scale of the place. They're hauling before the authorities. What's the complaint? It says that their profit was gone, but is that the complaint that they raised before the magistrates? Yeah, they're throwing the city into confusion. They're just confusing us. Now, who did they grab? Paul and Silas. But there's four of them there. Where's Timothy and Luke? You ever thought about that? Why didn't they grab all four of them? You know, they were off getting the lunch or something when it happened. It's quite possible. But I think there's a clue there, maybe. And again, it's just my supposition on this one. I'll put that up at the beginning. But it says, these men, pointing to Paul and Silas, are teaching things and throwing the city into confusion. They being what? They were Jewish. And we can't do that because we're what? We're Romans. Now, Timothy is the son of a Greek and a Jewish person. Maybe he didn't look as Jewish as Paul and Silas did. How about Luke? He's Greek, right? So it could very well have been just they grabbed the two guys that looked Jewish to haul them up there before the people, right? But that's the accusation. Now, if they look Jewish, and the accusation is they're turning our city into confusion, and the magistrates don't want that. The magistrates would be, they might have been Greek, but they would have been Roman appointees in that area. Okay, we don't know what level of government they're before, but in that town of Philippi, Philippi is a Roman colony, administered according to the laws of Rome, and we don't have sedition, confusion, rebellion in our cities, okay? Rome wants one thing mostly. Okay, two things. The one thing they want is taxes from everybody. And the second thing that they want to ensure that the taxes flow is peace and quiet, right? So that's really how it all played together. So when anybody went to disrupt that, they fell into disfavor with the Romans. And so that's what these people are playing on. They're throwing the city into confusion. So, what do they do about it? Well, they grab Paul and Silas. They've stirred up the crowd. They've hit the right themes, right? You ever notice? I mean, all you got to do is just watch political conventions and things. How do you get the crowd rallied up? You push the right buttons, right? You find the rallying point, the things that people are going to agree with, and you kind of phrase it in such a way that it It sounds like something people ought to get excited about. And people with the right charisma can pull a crowd together and get them going. And so the crowd rose up together against them, and the chief magistrates tore their robes off them and proceeded to order them to be beaten with rods. Now, being beaten with rods is slightly less than being scourged, okay? Being scourged, they use a whip and whatnot. This other one is like, I think you've seen the news articles about flogging. You know, people would take a cane or a caning. Sure, go ahead. No, it's just, and so they were just, and there was no set number of things. They just sort of beat them for a while. Oh, emperor worship had been going on for some time. Yes, it had been going on for some time. They probably would have been alluding to something like that, but I don't think they necessarily would have had any details. These men are teaching something different, and all we have to do is look at it from a prejudicial standpoint, which is, again, I think why, when it says they were Jews. They didn't even bother to find out the fact that they weren't teaching Judaism. Okay, they're teaching Christianity, but in that world, in that time, there wasn't a distinction there. And so I don't think they even necessarily cared what it was they were teaching. It's just that we can take that phrase and we can be, you know, racial and biased about it and inflame everybody against them, and away we go. And does that happen today? Are people accused of things that if you look at it just kind of slightly, you can see where it kind of is that, but it's not really? All the time. It happens all the time. So they're not really trying to be analytical here. This is just a crowd. Oh, yeah, same thing happened to Jesus. And so, you know, people, when they're trying to trump up charges, they're just trying to find something that will get the crowds going and that can be used well enough to stick to accomplish their purpose. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is just humankind here, you know. And I think that's part of what we see in this reflection is that it's been, a couple thousand years now. Things haven't changed all that much. I mean, we may have the internet and electronics and things like that, but human nature just hasn't changed all that much. So they grab Paul and Silas. Off to prison they go after being beaten. And you notice, how much of a trial did they get? They were obviously guilty, right? You don't need a trial when somebody's obviously guilty. People still kind of think that way today. You know, our judicial system, I think, is designed to kind of slow things down a bit. And maybe that's not a bad thing in some cases. It slows down too much sometimes. But when you have time to think or you take time to reflect on it, quite often the conclusions that you come to are different, as we're going to see with these people as well. So they're beaten. The crowd grows up. Then when they struck them with many blows, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to guard them securely. Now, there's another phrase. This would have been a Roman prison again. And the Roman prisons had varying levels of security depending on why you were in there. What was the jailer's job? Pretty simple. Keep the prisoners in the prison. That's his job. Okay? And secondary to that, sort of make sure that they don't just die on you. Other than that, comfort was not an issue. You know, all of those kinds of things played insignificant roles compared to make sure they're still in there and try to make sure they don't die. Other than that, that's it. Now, this jailer has delivered two guys who've just been beaten, and the authorities say, you make sure these guys are secure. What's that jailer going to do? We're going to put them someplace where it's going to be really hard for them to get out or for anybody else to get to them. See, that's the other thing about being secure, right? It's not just them getting out, but somebody else coming maybe and helping them get out. What's the penalty for a Roman jailer if he lets his charges escape? He's a dead man. He's a dead man. And we'll see in a minute that when that happens, that this Roman jailer decides that he's going to kill himself. We have to understand that that's a cultural thing as well. That it was better for a Roman who knew that he was going to be sentenced to die to take his own life. Because if he went through the process, was convicted and executed, then he lost all rights to everything that he owned, including any possessions that might go to his family. And so it basically ruined his family. By taking his own life, then at least his family was able to inherit and those kinds of things. Okay, so that was cultural. You have to understand that as we go in and look at what's going on here. There are cultures still today where your reputation is such that going through the shameful process of being discovered that you've done something wrong and being punished for it just is too much. And people will take their own lives over that. And culturally, there are places where that still occurs. So these handed over to the Roman jailer. The Roman jailer goes and takes them into the innermost part. And notice there it says, having received such a command, he threw them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. Now, quite often from the archaeology that they've dug up, the jails didn't necessarily have lots of, you know, iron bars and things on them. One of the ways that you'd make sure nobody escapes is you just chain them to the wall, right? So there were a lot of chains on walls kinds of things. And if you really wanted to make sure they don't escape, make sure they can't walk, okay? What are stocks? Anybody seen stocks? Surely you've been to one of these old town kind of things and seen the stocks, right? You got a couple of boards, you got some holes in them, clamp the boards, and voila, you know, you're immobilized. My favorite version of that, in Europe sometimes if you go to one of these like medieval torture museums or whatever, if two people, I should have gotten a picture of it. I'll try to remember next week to bring a picture of one. If there were two people who were arguing and could not get along and they went to court to try to get their argument settled, or somebody else said, I'm just tired of these people arguing, I want this settled. They had this one where there were two holes for heads. The board is like about 5 foot long. And there's two holes for heads, and then there's holes for hands like this, okay? And they would lock them both into it facing each other. And, you know, and they'd have to stay that way for, you know, a period of like a day. And and somebody would come and ask, is your dispute settled? Whether you got out or not based on both of you saying, yeah, we're okay now. So, you know, people have done these kinds of things to settle arguments and whatnot. So he's locked up in the stocks. Now, keep in mind they've been beaten. This is not a comfortable situation. And so when it says about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns of praise to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Why weren't they sleeping? It's nighttime. It's midnight. Well, Paul and Silas are singing, so nobody else can sleep, but why aren't Paul and Silas sleeping? It's because they're hurting, folks. They've been beaten. They haven't had any medical attention after that. They're probably still low-level bleeding going on their backs. They're in stocks and chains. This is not a comfortable position to be in. It wasn't designed to be comfortable. And so you've got one or two choices in those kind of things. You can moan and complain, which is what 99% of the people would do, right? Yeah, and I think that's part of it. They're suffering, they're in pain, and so what are they doing? By this singing and their praying, they're calling on God. Now, I find it interesting that they're doing it audibly. I think not only was the singing out loud, but the praying was out loud as well. Right? And what was one of the results of that, it says? Yeah, their prisoners are listening to this. Now you got to ask yourself, is this normal behavior? Would most people under these circumstances be praying and singing? I don't think so. But that's what they're doing. And the people are listening. Some of them are probably wishing they shut up so they can go to sleep, but others are intrigued, right? They want to know why these people are doing it. And suddenly there came a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison house were shaken, and immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's chains were unfastened. And when the jailer awoke and saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." Okay. they're being released miraculously from prison. What does this sound like? There's lots of repeats here in the book. Absolutely. It's just what happened to Peter, right? They were in prison, and Peter was released. And here Paul and Silas are in prison. They're being released. But was it always when a Christian was locked up into prison that they got released? Who's one of the classic examples there that was already hit an axe? James, right? Who was put into prison and was executed. And then Peter gets put into prison and is not executed. Now Paul and Silas are put into prison. Do they know what their fate might be when they're going there? I don't think so. But when the doors are open and they see that they're going to be released, and it says the jailer awoke. The jailer's asleep. He's already got everybody secured. He's not too worried about it till the morning. But this earthquake happens. He sees that the doors are open. The chains are off. Things are in chaos probably as people are trying to figure out what's going on. And that's when he decides that, okay, before anybody else finds out about this, I better be dead. Now, I don't know if Paul could see him or not, but Paul would know what was going through this jailer's mind, right? Paul's a Roman citizen in addition to being a Jew. He understands the rules and the regulations, and so he calls out and he tells the jailer, we're all here. Nobody's left. Don't worry about it. Now, can you imagine the guy sitting there ready to kill himself when this voice kind of comes out of the background and says, stop. Don't hurt yourself. We're all here. What's going through his mind at this point? Well, we see part of it as we go on, right? So the jailer then called for lights and rushed in. And trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. And after he had brought them out, he said, sirs, what must I do to be saved? Now, what a question to be put there. And he's been asleep, so I don't think he's been hearing the singing and the praying, or maybe some of it before he went to sleep. We don't know. But he's asking this question, what must I do to be saved? I'm not convinced that he's talking about his soul and salvation here at this point. What's he really got on his mind? What? Living. He's got on his mind, I've just stopped from killing myself by the voice of this man. He's basically got my life in his hands. And he says, what do I have to do? Yeah, yeah. And I don't know how many would be there at this point. With an earthquake awakened, and he says he called for lights, there's more than one person at least that we know that are accompanying him now, probably some other soldiers. So, you know, they would have might have had some expectations along that line, but whatever it is, they're sitting in front of Paul and going, our life is in your hands, or at least the jailer's was, you know, his subordinates maybe. His life is in his hands. But Paul is going to take advantage of the situation. Because he's brought them out. When he says out, that's out of the prison where he's supposed to be holding them, right? I don't know what they did with everybody else. Left the guard, locked them back up. I don't know. But clearly it's Paul and Silas that are the center here. And they said, believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved, you and your household. And they spoke the word of the Lord to him together with all who were in his house. And he took them that very hour of the night and washed their wounds. And immediately he was baptized, he and all his household. And he brought them into his house and set food before them and rejoiced greatly, having believed in God with his whole household. I think what we're looking at here is Paul took advantage of an opportunity, did he not? I don't think this salvation and Christianity or anything was on this guy's mind when he was standing before Paul initially and saying, what must I do? But Paul had the spiritual side of it, right? And he says, you've got to believe in Jesus. And I can't help but think that the first question out of this guy's mouth would have been, and who is that? Because what does it say that he did next? They taught him. He started out with something that would catch his attention, and then he taught them what they had to do, and he was receptive at that point, realizing, of course, in that case, he not only had the miracle of the earthquake and everything else, which other people would have looked at, by the way, as simply natural event, right? But how natural is it for all of the chains to fall off of people and, you know, those kinds of things? So there's a lot mixed in here. Yes, enough that people might be able to dismiss it, but this man knows differently. And so he's seen it, and he's convinced of it. But now they tell him the why. And what's the result? What does he do? They're baptized, he and his household. So it's not just him who's listening. It's his household. We don't know who all that comprises. Wife, kids, servants, whoever. But they're all in on this and all understanding that his life was saved and that now they're being taught the gospel, the good news. And that had the favorable result, right? So he washes them, he tends to them, feeds them, takes care of them. Now this is through the night, folks. Things have got to be getting kind of tired by this point. But morning finally comes, and it reminds me whenever we're keeping people at our house, especially longtime friends and whatnot, the saying is it just doesn't take very long to spend the night at the Holiday House because typically you're up like talking and then you get to bed late and then you get up early or maybe because, you know, especially if there's young kids around or whatever that, you know. But that's part of this association, right? And so Paul now is part of that with his household. And then comes the morning when the day came. The chief magistrate sent their policemen saying, release those men. And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, the chief magistrates have sent to release you. Therefore, come out now and go in peace. But Paul said to them, they have beaten us in public without trial, men who are Romans, and have thrown us into the prison, and now they are sending us away secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and bring us out. And the policemen reported these words to the chief magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Romans. And they came and appealed to them. And when they brought them out, they kept begging them to leave the city. And they went out of the prison and entered into the house of Lydia. And when they saw the brethren, they encouraged them and departed. Okay. I've often wondered what Paul was trying to accomplish with this, no, we've been wrong. You let them come and bring us out. In some ways, that seems like ungracious. Maybe a Christian would have, you know, should have said, oh, fine, everything's all right now. I forgive everybody. Yes, we'll leave quietly. And that's not what Paul did. Why? What were the circumstances? I think that's a good part of it. Paul's been slandered here, has he not?
Well, yeah, I basically go back to that verse where one says that they refused to do something unlawful, and in fact these men had done something unlawful.
Right. I think this is part of Paul trying to clear their name there in the city, for one thing. But I think there's another motive as well, and that is if by claiming their Roman citizenship, they've now thrown some kind of fear into these people that says, oops, we messed up. We grabbed them because they look Jewish, forgetting that some of those fellows are Roman citizens as well. Paul knows that he's going to be going through this region. You think news doesn't travel in that day and age just because they don't have the internet? No, news traveled around. And remember when they're going from these cities, as we've seen in the past and we'll see, some of the Jewish people who were upset at their teaching followed them around, right? And were trying to make trouble for them. And so Paul's not wanting to leave this doubt about themselves and this potentially having committed a crime and then snuck out of the city. Can you see how that would just be kind of one of these things that would potentially follow them around and continue to get them in trouble? Absolutely. He's got a young church there that he's got to think of. Yeah, and I think what you're seeing here is Paul using the resources that are available to him through the government authorities that are there to try to help the well-being of both his cause in terms of his freedom and ability to spread the gospel, but also the cause of that local congregation that's being established. So it's not a matter of him just having to be all meek and mild-mannered and accept whatever comes along and whatnot. Paul is trying to do forward-thinking. He is trying to make sure these people are taken care of. And in fact, we see a change in the pronouns that are used here. When it says that they left the city, what's the difference there? If the whole group had gone, what would you have expected there? We left the city, right? And so, who's staying behind? At least Luke. And what we find is that when they come back through the region, Timothy's still there. So Luke and Timothy get left at Philippi to help those brethren grow and to continue the efforts that Paul and Silas started. So I think that's big in Paul and Silas's mind. Yeah, they've taken the brunt of it. Fortunately, Timothy and Luke were kind of left to the side in this particular circumstance, but we can use that to our benefit. They can stay. We'll leave. Sure.
He took them out of the prison and claimed them and taught them. Did they go back to the prison?
I don't know, but I suspect that he just left them in his house. That's what I would suspect. Or if they went back to prison, they weren't thrown into the stocks again. It just says that they would have come out. The likelihood is he lived very close to the prison. Being the guard, he would have been there so that he could be there at a moment's notice. Yeah. So I suspect they went back to the prison. But at what point? After the message? Right after they were cleaned up? I don't know. It says he put food down before them. So they spent some time at his house. My reading is that they would have spent most of the night there. And maybe just going back to the prison in the morning when it's time for things to be, kind of turned loose or whatever. And so they would have been kind of sitting on the front porch of the prison rather than deep inside when this message came. Oh, yeah. When he takes them back, which it's obvious from the text that he does, I doubt there's any mistreatment at this point, though. No mistreatment, right? And so we've got a nucleus of a congregation being started there in Philippi, and I think that's why we have the story there in Acts 16 that tells us that. It starts with Lydia and her household, a woman of some means, Jewish. What's the next big piece that's added to it? A Philippian who is a Roman servant. I mean, basically, he's an employee of the Roman government, right? And Greek. Or Roman, whatever. And that's your nucleus of your congregation. During a time when one of the most difficult things they were having to do was getting the Jews and the Gentiles to get together.
When Paul says we are all still here, that's the implication that he's talking about the prisoners.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, all the prisoners. None of the prisoners escaped. How many there were, I don't know. There were some other than them because we know that they heard the singing and whatnot. Could have been one, could have been two, could have been a houseful, I don't know. They didn't tend to keep a lot of people in prison for lengthy times back then. Prison was your holdover point. It was where you stayed while they were figuring out whether you were going to, be tried, punished, fined, or killed, and then you were done with it. It's not like prison today.
Kind of consider as well, too,
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, there's just a lot going on here, and we're just given this bare bones overview of it. And so there's a lot of things we don't know for sure. But the reason I wanted to spend so much time on this morning is I think when you really look at a story and you read the story and you think about the time and the places and the people and look at why they were doing what they were doing and how they accomplished the deeds that they did, you can find that it's not only was the hand of God with them in a very powerful sense, but you find that there was human nature involved and that these people were taking advantage of the opportunities that they had to do good. And that they were worried about things like strengthening the church, their reputation. All of those kinds of factors came into play here as they came in to the city of Philippi. Paul and Silas have to leave pretty quickly, but they've left behind a nucleus that's going to grow. Okay, that's all we have time for this morning.